Hello to you all and welcome to Viewpoints. Boris Chassaigne here with you for the next 30 minutes. On today's show, in New Brunswick, self-serve community food banks fall victim to abuse.
We stocked a couple of times this happened with a lot of food, and 15 minutes later, everything is gone and there's only been one vehicle in the driveway. And then those people actually tried to sell the food.
In British Columbia, a local school principal looks at the realities of cell phone use as the province legislates to ban cells in classes next September.
People could argue that some of the lack of attention span we see is due to constant scrolling, dopamine hits, and all that stuff that comes along with constant usage.
Alberta introduces a new program to prepare for floods and droughts.
Albertans are innovators and problem solvers who, when they see a problem, roll up their sleeves and get to work.
Health authorities are in high alert across the country as measles is making a comeback. A growing number of cases have been reported in four provinces so far. Authorities worry that the situation could get much worse.
People have, may not be vaccinated for measles, so we want to make sure that people take a very cautious approach and make sure they do what they can to make sure they're protected.
A recent report contradicts Uber's contention that its drivers are making $33 an hour.
They don't have a wait list. We really think that this exacerbates the issue of flooding the market and diluting individual driver and rider earnings.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
Follow us on X at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks for keeping us company. Despite some misuse in recent months, both the Sackville Community Sharing Cupboard and its predecessor, Station 8 Community Fridge in New Brunswick, have decided to continue to supply area residents with much-needed groceries on flexible schedules. Both organizations operate like self-serve food banks. People can then walk in and pick up what they need at any time. Even if the model is convenient for people in need, it is also prone to occasional abuse. They have, from time to time, even been cleaned out entirely within a few minutes of restocking. Erica Butler sat down with some of the organizers behind the community food operations in Dorchester and Sackville, New Brunswick, to find out how things are going.
Community cupboards, or community fridges, are becoming a fixture of life in Tanchamar, thanks to high food prices and stagnating incomes, especially at the lower end of the income spectrum. The Dorchester Moving Forward Cooperative is also known as Station 8. The group first started their community fridge back in July 2022. The focus is on produce, and an anonymous corporate donor gives two truckloads of produce every week for Station 8 to distribute. The fridges are stocked daily by staff and volunteers working out of the Station 8 headquarters. Volunteer Wendy Keats says the fridge generally works as intended and gets lots of use.
A lot of times we're able to keep it full for the better part of the week, but it depends on what we get. We never know what we're going to get.
But Keats says there has also been times in recent months when the fridge has not been used as intended.
Well, we had a couple of indicators. So one is because we are there, kind of who, how many, things like that, that are coming and going. We were watching people with Nova Scotia license plates coming in and going out with six bags, for example, of food. So we were seeing that happen. We were also being informed by members of the community about people who were abusing it from, again, outside of the area. We also had evidence given to us of people coming and cleaning us out. Like we stocked a couple of times this happened with a lot of food, and 15 minutes later, everything is gone and there's only been one vehicle in the driveway. And then those people actually tried to sell the food.
The incidents of abuse, though they are few compared to the number of people using the community fridge on good terms, prompted Station 8 to make some changes to their operation. They stocked the fridge more often with less produce, started closing access overnight, and have more clearly defined their target clients according to region.
We did recently have a bigger problem where we were getting cleaned out by people. I don't know what Sackville's experience has been with that, but we did have, for just really a short period of time, people abusing the fridge. So we did have, that's why we made some changes and just 10 a.m. to 10 p.m.
That's Wendy Keats of Station 8 Community Fridge in Dorchester. Sackville's community sharing cupboard, located in a small shed just behind the Sackville Commons building on Lorne Street, has had similar experiences to those in Dorchester. The pantry opened in May 2023 and is stocked twice per week by volunteers Jacqueline and Tammy Fahey. The operation is a project of the Sackville Food Bank and is funded from the food bank budget, mostly consisting of donations. The Sackville cupboard also gets extra produce from Station 8 on a regular basis, and community members and users also bring extra food to the pantry to be shared among those who need it. But still, the Fahey's say there have been incidents where they have returned to the cupboard within minutes of restocking and found it cleaned out. And some clients also report issues. In some cases, the Fahey's have been able to speak to the people involved.
It seemed to resolve itself each time. It hasn't really continued. It hasn't been a problem. Like, say, we've only had those two or three specific episodes. That was it. We haven't really done it. There's not really too much we can do different, you know.
Wendy Keats says there's often an outcry on social media when problems occur, and she sees calls for security cameras and monitoring of operations. But all the organizers agree that's not a practical response and defeats the self-serve nature of the operation.
We're volunteers. We're going to chase down somebody that just took our stuff and what, go to their house?
Keats and the Fahey's all agree that the community fridge and community sharing cupboards, despite hiccups and issues, are working to get food distributed to those in need. And the need is real, says Tammy Fahey.
I think it's helping a lot of people. And in this time, they really need it. Okay, a few people have ruined it for everybody. So we're trying not to let that happen.
That's Tammy Fahey of the Sackville Community Sharing Cupboard.
Follow us on X at CanadaLJI. And listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
The government of Alberta has recently introduced its new drought and flood protection program. The five-year and $125 million program will provide municipalities and Indigenous communities with funds to help build flood and drought prevention infrastructure, such as burns, flood walls, and retention ponds. According to the provincial government, the current El Nino conditions are causing warm temperatures and little precipitation over the winter, which could lead to major droughts during the summer. Ryan Hunt is reporting on that story. Rebecca Schultz, Minister of Environment and Protected Areas, says this program is about funding the life-saving infrastructure needed to protect Alberta's communities for years to come.
Albertans understand all too well the devastating impacts that droughts and floods have on our homes, businesses, and critical infrastructure. And of course, the dangers that it poses to the safety of individuals and families in every corner of our province. But our province does not back down from a challenge. Albertans are innovators and problem solvers who, when they see a problem, roll up their sleeves and get to work. And that's exactly what we're doing here today. We know that communities have great ideas on project to make them drought and flood proof, but building this infrastructure, of course, is costly, and municipalities and Indigenous communities are already struggling with inflation and rising energy costs. That's why we're launching the Drought and Flood Protection Program to help communities build the infrastructure that they need to keep their people safe.
The program will see $125 million be invested into the program over the next 5 years as a part of Budget 2024, with the program set to roll out later this year. I'm Ryan Hunt. Points. Local news nationwide.
In a push to tackle online abuse, the federal Liberal government of Justin Trudeau has introduced new legislation called the Online Harms Act, Bill C-63, which proposes stricter sentences, new regulatory bodies, and changes to existing laws pertaining to internet usage. This new proposed federal bill was announced shortly after BC's Premier David Eby announced a stricter approach to the use of cell phones by students in classrooms across the province. province. That initiative was announced in late January of this year and is slated to be implemented in BC by next September. Jackson Grice is the principal at Houston Secondary School. He says that while this initiative to get kids off their phones in school is a good idea on paper, he has yet to see what supports will come with this new responsibility for educators and school staff. Here's part of his conversation with Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC.
Principal Grice, how invasive or distracting would you say cell phones are in your school currently?
I would say in our school currently, it would really depend on the child or the student. I would definitely say there are students that struggle immensely with cell phone usage in terms of it being a huge distraction to their learning. There's other students who it's not such a problem. I would say overall, though, if you look at pure student focus and engagement, I would say cell phones are a distracting thing that does hamper learning.
And do you think that restricting phone use will be a lengthy transition or smooth transition? We're looking at September of 2024 to enact this new rule.
I think when we heard this announced, I'm interested to see what are the parameters around this rule, because individual schools have their own kind of rules, regulations, and policies around cell phone usage. And here at Houston Secondary School this fall, for the first day of school, we enacted a cell phone rule that effectively banned using cell phones during bell times in classes. Mm-hmm. So we've already kind of test run this a little bit and seen what it can do. And, you know, I think for the most part, it's working effectively. And students, they get it, why they can't be on their phones during class time. So I think for us, it's going to be a pretty smooth transition. What I'm interested to see is, you know, is there any kind of teeth to this legislation? Is there any backup, or is it solely just placed on schools? And once again, we're monitoring it. But I think for this to be enacted long term, there needs to be policy backup, you know, at a higher level compared to the school level. When I say kind of provincial backup, you know, I think it needs to just be said, cell phones are not allowed, you know, bell to bell, right? And so every student coming into any school in BC knows what the rules are and kind of what the terms of engagement, so to speak, are around cell phones. So it's not even a question. We don't even have to have that battle at the school level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if this is all offloaded to the individual school, then, you know, we're once again getting in those one-on-one conflicts and situations with kids. It just needs to be a standard thing, I think, across the board at the provincial level. So all kids, regardless of whatever school they're in, they know they can't be on their phone during class time.
Now, my question that I had for you as an educator, someone who's in the environment of working with students and their not only education, but also their growth as young people, you know, as part of your job. What are the realities, especially in small northern communities, of online bullying or intimate images being shared among students, which is something that C63, at least three of the targeted concerns, have to do with?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say this has changed drastically. I remember probably around 2009, 2010, when students started appearing in schools with cell phones. That was a much different animal and beast compared to what it is today. And, you know, when I think of a portion of my job as an administrator, we're dealing with kind of the nitty-gritty disciplinary things, dysfunctional things that are happening in the world of teenagers. And, you know, just 10, 15 years ago, it was largely person-to-person conflicts. Now, I would say the majority of issues we deal with stem from conflict or misuse and or, you know, things that shouldn't be happening in the online world. Yeah. And that can be everything from texting to social media to inappropriate content. I think our teenagers live in that online world so much that, you know, it really dominates what they do and how they think in a lot of ways. So I would say for us at the school level, and you know, I don't think it's any different between a small community and a big center. I would say the majority of issues that come across our desks as school administrators, there's background that is stemming from something to do with a cell phone, something to do online, social media, that's where the action is. That's where the kids spend the vast majority of their time.
I saw a statistic from 2022 even that said half of Canadian kids between 7 and 11 have a cell phone. Mm-hmm. And that shocked me, but that probably doesn't surprise you at all. Mm-hmm. By the time that they're walking through your doors, they've lived with that cell phone, and that online life and persona has probably defined a lot of their personality, especially in these formative years.
Exactly. And, we're starting to see the first generations of kids coming through high school that they've grown up with phones. They've never actually lived in a world without a phone or instant access to technology. So, in a way, there's also some research out there that brain wiring and brain development is impacted. People could argue that some of the lack of attention span we see is due to constant scrolling, dopamine hits, and all that stuff that comes along with constant usage. So, I would say it definitely plays a role. It impacts kids. I think a lot of this legislation that's tabled, at least, is trying to minimize a lot of the negative things that happen. And from, my point of view, I've seen a lot of hurt over the years. A lot of students get into situations either consciously or unconsciously that have harmed them. And it's pretty sad to see. Whether or not this type of legislation will really change things, I don't know. Because, how do we get the word out to kids how to use these platforms appropriately? And they're so pervasive and so enticing that it's pretty tough. And, I don't know if their legislation is going to be just the one silver bullet to help all of this. I really think it's going to take a dramatic shift in terms of society from parenting, from the way we raise our children, as to how do we interact with people? How do we use these tools appropriately?
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
You're listening to Viewpoints with Boris Sassang.
Measles is making its way back in Canada, and health authorities are worried that more Canadians, and especially children, could be affected. Cases have so far been reported in Quebec, Ontario, Saskatchewan, and British Columbia. In Ontario, the Haliburton Cowartop Pine Ridge District Health Unit has begun its next round of communication to ensure that student vaccinations are up to date, and authorities are taking this situation very seriously. The health unit suggests all children and adults make sure their measles immunizations are up to date. Jeff Gard is in Cobourg, Ontario. He spoke with the HKPR Health Unit's Manager of Communicable Diseases and Prevention Control, Marion Rock.
The Haliburton Kawartha Pine Ridge District Health Unit is continuing its efforts to ensure all elementary and high school students have their current immunizations, and now suggesting all individuals make sure their measles vaccinations are up to date as well. The health unit said Tuesday there are 4 active cases of measles in Ontario, with 3 reports of cases in 2 other provinces as well. I spoke with Marianne Rock, the HKPR Health Unit's Manager of Communicable Diseases and Prevention Control.
So this is really a situation where we're seeing measles, obviously internationally, but we're also seeing them in Ontario, right? We're seeing them in the Greater Toronto Area, and at some point, hopefully not soon or hopefully not at all, measles might make its way to the HKPR area. And so it's just another call to arms, to make sure everyone checks their own, as an adult, their vaccination status for measles as well as children. And we know March break is just next week, and there's going to be lots of people traveling, I imagine. And so we know that you know, you visit different areas of the world, they have different recommendations around vaccines, and people have, you know, may not be vaccinated for measles. So we want to make sure that people take a very cautious approach and make sure they do what they can to make sure they're protected. So it sort of goes hand in hand with the ISPA or the enforcement we're doing. You know, it's just another reminder of the importance of vaccine. And we know that with COVID-19, a lot of people didn't have access to vaccinations because doctor's offices were closed and such. And so, it's just another reminder of the importance of how important vaccines are to keep everyone healthy.
Measles is a highly contagious virus spread through coughing and sneezing that can live up to 2 hours in the air. Symptoms of measles include fever, a red blotchy rash, red watery eyes, and white spots in the mouth. Measles is prevented by vaccination, and Ontario's routine immunization schedule includes 2 doses of the highly effective measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines for children before the ages of 7 years old. Rock said infants should receive their first dose at 12 months before the second dose between the ages of 4 and 6 years old.
Generally speaking, that's all you need you need those 2 doses. But we know that vaccine eligibility and research has changed over the years. And so we know that there's some adults, particularly those born before 1970, that may not have those 2 doses. And so it's really important that they talk to their doctor about making sure they're up to date. Generally speaking, an adult born after 1970 should have 2 documented doses of measles. But again, there's all these different criteria. There's high risk criteria. Healthcare workers are a different situation. And again, want to make sure that those people are definitely protected because they're the ones caring for those who may have measles and other people who are sick.
I'm Jeff Gard.
Okay, man, it's going. Okay.
You're listening to Viewpoints.
We stay in Ontario, where Ridefair TO's legislative poverty report takes exception with Uber Canada's claim about driver income. Uber claims that their drivers are making $33 an hour, whereas Ridefair TO, in their own report, found the wage to be more like $6.37 per hour. Ridefair TO is a Toronto-based organization that advocates for ride-sharing platforms to be governed by fair regulations. The report says that there are 3 reasons why the wage is so low: too many drivers, low pay rates, and wait times between calls where they are not making any money. Details with Owen Thompson in Toronto.
Co-author of Ridefair's report, JJ Fuser, appeared before the committee to answer questions and further explain the data. Fuser says,
so there are 2 issues. First, the number of rides has blown way past our prior estimates. So I think we can safely conclude that the kind of under-regulated industry led to induced demand for car-based travel. We know from studies in Toronto and other cities that this demand has come first and foremost at the expense of public transit. The second issue is that the increase in the number of drivers is more than double the increase in the number of daily trips. And that is why we see some of the results that we reported about 2 weeks ago in legislative poverty, that, you know, if you start from Uber's median, that the median driver earns $33.35 per hour. You take into account how long they actually drive on average and the kind of expenses they have to pay out of that, and they're left with $6.37. That gives you sort of a sense of the dynamics behind that. The provincial policy fix that the company has offered to pay 120% of minimum wage, but only for that piece of engaged time, also does not provide a floor. Your expected earnings, given that median, are about, given the provincial minimum wage, are about $2.50, but it can go lower. And that's what we need. We need a system to stop that. People aren't getting work. They're not getting paid for their expenses. It's a waste of driver's time, but also a waste of road space and carbon allowance. A more efficient system protects communities and drivers and customers, because drivers can improve their earnings even before any adjustments to fares are made if they're just working more.
Aaron Binder, a co-owner of Segway of Ontario, an electric scooter company, says that they hear stories from customers coming to have their electric scooters repaired who are gig workers for food delivery services like Uber Eats and Skip the Dishes. Binder says,
from the folks that get their scooters repaired from us, And a lot of them share how they have to now navigate an oversaturated market when it comes to gig work. And a lot of them are often unsure of their rights and struggle to make ends meet, whether that's rideshare or food delivery. And a lot of these stories reflect a broader trend that we've observed in our business. And that's few rideshare drivers and food delivery riders manage stability. Some can do it, but a lot of them are facing daunting economic insecurity. Uber has this open door policy for new riders. They don't have a wait list. And we really think that this exacerbates the issue of flooding the market and diluting individual driver and rider earnings. And because of their massive upfront investment over the years, they've been able to afford some of the best lobbyists in the world. And as they've argued that workers being contractors is a good thing for everyone, people have actually listened. But the truth does tend to come out, and we disagree with that. We know that many drivers can spend good portions of their shifts unpaid and waiting for a call. By implementing transparent wage policies, guaranteeing job security for gig workers, and committing to fair labor practices, we can foster a gig economy, if we need to have one, that uplifts our community, supports small business, and ensures dignity for all workers. If we don't do this, the price we all pay for convenience will be somebody else's poverty.
This committee comes only a few days after Uber and Lyft threatened to pull out of Minneapolis. Minneapolis City Council were introducing an ordinance to ensure ride-hailing service workers for services like Uber and Lyft were guaranteed to make minimum wage. Minneapolis isn't the only city that has tried to do this. Michael Reich, an economics professor at University of Berkeley, has been conducting studies for gig drivers, which he calls TNC drivers. Reich says,
"My remarks today draw from our studies of driver pay and minimum compensation policies in these and other jurisdictions. I understand from a recent study that the economic conditions of gig drivers in Ontario are similar to those in these other areas. The drivers receive well below the equivalent of the applicable minimum wage for employees. Meanwhile, the number of TNC vehicles in Toronto has grown rapidly and faster than the growth of passenger demand. This setup opposes the interests of the companies and the drivers, unfortunately. To respond to these problems, I understand the city is considering imposing a pause or cap on the number of TNC licenses, as well as setting a minimum pay standard per trip. New York City enacted both of these policies in August 2018 after our report and recommendation."
Toronto City Council has adopted the motion to allow city staff to conduct their analysis of Ridefare TO's data.
That's it for us at Viewpoints. Our reporters were Erica Butler, Pamela Hassan, Ryan Hunt, Jeff Gard, and Owen Thompson. Thanks to our national editors, Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to write, yes you can, radio@frequencynews.ca. That's radio@frequencynews.ca. I'm Boris Hassan, your host and producer. That's it for us this week. Until the next, ciao.
Viewpoints.